Today on The Grave Talks, Ghosted, a history of ghost hunting and why we keep looking. A conversation with author Alice Vernon. In her new book, Ghosted, a history of ghost hunting and why we keep looking, Alice Vernon sets out to chase the one thing she isn't even sure exists and discovers that the search for ghosts says more about the living than the dead. What begins as a skeptic's experiment becomes a haunting journey through centuries of belief. From candlelit Victorian seances to ghost hunts streamed on YouTube, she explores how our obsession with the afterlife has evolved, but never disappeared. Each new invention, from telegrams to EMF meters, becomes another way to reach across the void, to prove that love, grief, or even guilt can outlast death. As she moves deeper into Britain's most haunted places, she begins to feel the same pull that's gripped believers for generations. Maybe the ghosts aren't what we think they are. Maybe they're reflections of everything we've lost and everything we still hope to find. Part history, part investigation, Ghosted is a chilling, intimate exploration of why we keep trying to prove what we can't explain, and why our search for the dead may really be a search for meaning among the living. So, Alice, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today about your new book. It's called Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking. Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm really anxious to dive into this book.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Carol.
Now, you actually are Dr. Alice Vernon, by the way.
I am.
Anybody who works through a PhD, you deserve that doctor title.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it was tough. When I handed my PhD in, I actually got shingles, which is chicken pox.
But very painful.
Yeah, so that's how my body was like, right, we're done.
Oh my gosh. And you teach it, now I'm never going to say this properly because it's in Wales and you teach at a university. So if you would please pronounce where you teach.
Yeah, so I teach at Aberystwyth University in Wales.
Aberystwyth. Yes. Okay. So
that's good. That's fine. Yeah.
I try. So I want to ask you about how you became interested in even writing a book about the history of ghost hunting, because it's going to go two ways, and I have a feeling I know which way it goes. It's either you had paranormal experiences as a child and you've been fascinated by it, or it could also be you didn't, and you're skeptical and you're kind of fascinated by it.
That's a really good question. So I think it actually comes from skepticism. But the book really came from my first book. So Ghosted is my second book. And my first book was called Night Terrors. And that came out 3 years ago. And it was nonfiction again. And that was to do with sort of spooky sleep disorders called parasomnias, things like sleep paralysis, lucid dreaming, nightmares, night terrors, and hallucinations that occur in the middle of the night. Because I have all of them. I'm very lucky to say that I have pretty much all of them. Yes, I have the whole basket of sleep disorders.
I would love to have you on to talk about that book because that's something I'm just fascinated by.
Yeah, it is very strange and scary to experience. So I've grown up waking up in the middle of the night and seeing a figure standing at the side of my bed. And if it's sleep paralysis, I can't move. But sometimes it's just a hallucination. And so I've grown up kind of being used to that and almost kind of shrugging it off. So I wrote this book, Night Terrors, and then that led me into thinking about how some experiences of ghosts and sort of encounters with the paranormal, they could be explained by sleep paralysis or hallucinations or that kind of thing. So I'd started to do kind of a bit of research into ghosts and the Society for Psychical Research, these sort of ghost hunting societies. And yeah, that just led me into doing the research for Ghosted. But I think as well, as a teenager, I remember watching Most Haunted for the first time in about 2006. And Most Haunted was the reality TV ghost hunting show. And it's dreadful. It's like a British institution. And it's just so entertaining and so awful. And I remember watching that and being so glued to it. It was like unlike anything I'd ever met, ever watched before. So that, I think, just made me really interested in ghosts kind of all my life anyway.
Right off the bat, I think it's in the first chapter of the book, you wrote, "I don't believe in ghosts, but I want to." Then later in the book, you wrote, "I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm going to look for them." And I was like, look at her kind of changing. So I was wondering, as you wrote the book, and we'll dive into it more, did your views on the paranormal evolve or change a little bit?
Yes, I think they definitely did. I went into writing Ghosted from quite a hardcore skeptic view, and I was going to write Ghosted as a pretty much an entirely humorous book. I mean, there are some really silly things in Ghosted because there's so much fraud, and I bought this haunted doll off eBay. And you know,
I do want to talk about the haunted doll.
We'll get to Bev. Yeah, she is here. She's beside me. So we'll get to Bev. But yeah, so it was going to be quite a funny book. And as I was doing research, I realized how much grief and bereavement is involved in the history of our need to look for evidence for ghosts, which really problematized how I wrote it. And I found that there were some instances where I couldn't just kind of scoff and say, oh, look at these gullible people, how could they fall for such obvious fraud and all this kind of stuff. It really problematized it because it made me realize that, yes, on the one hand, people were being exploited because they were grieving. But on the other hand, it really did seem to kind of tangibly help people. But also ghost hunting. I did go on a couple of ghost hunts, and I realized how much fun it is. It is a really good social activity when it's done kind of responsibly and ethically. It is a really fun social activity, and it's a really good way to experience history as well. So I think that's really important. And yeah, so on one of these ghost hunts, I did experience something a bit peculiar, which I think was just my rational brain trying to kind of make sense of something I was perceiving. But it's just given me that little bit of doubt in my skepticism and that kind of need to keep looking as well.
You did go to some extremes too, as far as your research, because you did do ghost hunts, but you also, did you join a group, a ghost hunting group?
Yes. So yeah. I became an accredited paranormal investigator.
Yes. So I'm like, way to dive in and really learn your subject matter.
Is to get a certificate in it, which right. I have stuck to my office door, which in case any students walk past and, you know, they're having a bit of trouble with poltergeist activity, who are they going to call? Me.
Alice.
I'm Alice Vernon, because I am an accredited paranormal investigator, and I'm very proud of it.
I hope it was easier than the PhD.
It was, actually. I did have to write an essay. It was very serious. There was no slacking involved.
Well, and yes, I appreciate that. I do appreciate that they made you jump through some hoops.
And yes, yeah. It was a full day course, and the instructor was quite kind of like aggressive PE teacher sort of vibes. He was very much like, this is how you ghost hunt. This is not how you ghost hunt. You've got to do it properly. Otherwise, I'll get angry. It's like, okay, yes, we'll all be very good. And then we had to write this essay. And then, yeah, got a certificate.
So when you started to write the book, did you have the idea of kind of about, I would say you cover about 200 years. So you go back into the spiritualism movement is kind of where you really dive in. Although, you know, reports of it go back farther than then. But I think spiritualism is a good place to start because that was such an odd time. It was in the U.S., England as well. And I think that the grief part really ties into spiritualism. When you look at here in the U.S., the Civil War, you know, Mary Todd Lincoln is hosting seances in the White House. And it goes through World War II. So it's really kind of the people who wanted that connection was they were trying to connect with a loved one because of grief and death.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I decided to start it with the rise of spiritualism in the 1840s was because I think our attitudes to death changed then quite a lot, and I think maybe that's why our attitudes to ghosts changed, because really prior to the 1840s, when spiritualism first kind of started, obviously there are kind of exceptions to this, but they're kind of few and far between. But ghosts would appear very kind of Shakespeare's Hamlet style, and they'd maybe point and give a message, or say, avenge my death, so and so killed me, go and kill them, that kind of thing. It was just a message, a single message relayed. And in the 1840s, you get the Fox sisters, the infamous Fox sisters from New York, who came up with this system, which was called the spiritual telegraph, because you start to see kind of science and sort of the supernatural sort of starting to blend a little bit. And they came up with this system of knocking to contact the spirit that allegedly haunted the farmhouse where they lived, Mr. Splitfoot. And suddenly this two-way conversation at that point in time, which I suppose is after just after the Civil War, when people were still grieving and things like that, it just took off and it spread internationally, particularly in Great Britain, but also Australia and New Zealand had a massive spiritualist community as well. And you do see it spike. Spiritualism especially spikes when there are major periods of grief. So after or in the aftermath of the First World War, spiritualism had kind of started to dwindle a little bit, but then war happens and everybody is grieving. And I think that is why people really turn to spiritualism, because I think most importantly perhaps there was a book that was written called Raymond, and that was
Oh,
by
yeah, that
Sir
was interesting, that part of the book.
yeah Yeah, so Sir Oliver Lodge was a member of the Society for Psychical Research, so he was no stranger to spiritualism. But he was still quite sceptical, really, and he lost his son Raymond in the war, aged about 26 or something, really horrible. And Sir Oliver Lodge was just ruined by it. And a medium contacted him and said, "Raymond has appeared at my séance. Do you want to come and talk to him?" And you see in the book Raymond, because Oliver Lodge is writing all of these reports of these seances, you see him get absolutely sucked into it. His other sons that were still alive, they're a bit more dubious, but you can really see Sir Oliver Lodge just absolutely falling for this. And what's most poignant, and I think what really problematized my research and how I wrote the book, was Sir Oliver Lodge's wife. And there's a little bit in Raymond where she says, "Oh, we can face Christmas now," which I thought was just so gut-wrenchingly sad. And there were so many books after Raymond that were written exactly the same way. People would go to a seance and they get in touch with their dead son or husband or whatever, and they would write these books from the messages that they received in the seance. And I think my interpretation of it from a kind of sociological perspective is that everybody was grieving. There was so much loss that, pretty much everybody had lost a son or a brother or a husband. And so nobody's loss felt special. But then Oliver Lodge comes along and Raymond, the book, comes along, and suddenly everybody knew Raymond's name. The book was sent to soldiers on the front line as a kind of like strange book of comfort. And I think, obviously, Raymond did make quite a lot of money as a book, but I don't think it was the money that led to all of these kind of copycat books. I think some of these people who were grieving saw that the book Raymond was really popular and that everybody knew Raymond, and so why shouldn't they know about their son or husband or father or whatever? So I think spiritualism was a way for people to, I guess, feel like their particular loss was special too in some way, and that it was for them to feel like their loss was special in some way too. And I guess just allowed them to feel like their dead loved one their last moments weren't in bits in a ditch. It was in this sort of beautiful spiritualist afterlife called Summerland, which was this sort of lovely utopian place. So I think spiritualism, yes, you can mock it and you can be skeptical and you can kind of, you know, scoff at it. But I think spiritualism was very useful in helping people process their grief.
And it's interesting because you look at it now and you're like, how did those people fall for that? But some of the people were definitely opportunistic and they're in it for the money and they've got ectoplasm or look, the phantom is coming out from behind the door. And I can't remember who it is in the book, but it's her and she's covered in a sheet. But nobody had any experience with special effects or anything like that. They'd never seen anything like this. And it's in a dark room and they're buying into it. And I think they buy into it because they so desperately want to connect with that loved one and they believe they can, that kind of leads them into buying into all of it. And I think there's so many things actually from that movement to today that still apply. There's still opportunistic people. Look at the ghost hunting shows. Look at the YouTube videos. Some are legit. Other people are just making some money off of it.
So, yeah, you really do see that in the history of ghost hunting. So the case that you were referring to was Sir William Crookes and the medium Florence Cook. And that was all to do with money. So Florence Cook, this was sort of in the 1870s. And Florence Cook was a young, pretty medium, and everybody was flocking to her in Great Britain. And she was sort of managed by her parents, who were making a lot of money. But there were other mediums that were a bit jealous of Florence Cook, and people were kind of scrutinizing her. And so her parents thought, well, if we get a scientist in to kind of lend credibility to Florence, then, you know, that will make her popular and, you know, she can't be touched then. So they got Sir William Crookes, who was a very celebrated chemist, very important and renowned chemist. So kind of like, you know, the equivalent of, I don't know, having Stephen Hawking or, you know, some massive, famous, well-known scientist come and investigate. And so he came to these seances. And again, you can see in his reports that he gets sucked into it. Not so much to do with grief. It's more to do with the fact that he kind of started to get a bit of a crush on Florence Cook. I know.
That's going to skew your opinion real fast.
Well, yes, hardly impartial there. But Florence Cook had this trick. So by the 1870s, the normal kind of seances and table tilting and knocking, that was kind of old hat at that point. And so Florence Cook did this new and exciting thing, which was that she would go into a cupboard and she'd make some ooh sounds. And then the cupboard door would open, shall we say, and out would come a ghost called Katie King. And it was just Florence Cook in a bed sheet, you know, just kind of making some weird sounds. And it's weird because it's almost like Sir William Crookes is in love with Katie King, the ghost, more than Florence Cook.
Oh, that's interesting. Living.
It is. It's like, you know, there's something about the fact that he thinks that Katie King comes to see him specifically and that he's honored with her presence. And I think that makes him feel special. But yeah, he really, really falls in love and it clouds his judgment. And it nearly ruined his reputation as a very, very well-known chemist.
That's so interesting that he would fall in love with the ghost and not her, because he had to have known it's the same person.
I mean, you know, believe what you want to believe. And I think he very firmly wanted to believe that Katie King was this remarkable, remarkable ghost.
And I do think, you know, you bring it up in the book that I think that you can be influenced by your desire to have an experience. You know, even when you went out ghost hunting, and I was in Spain recently, I had a very crazy sleep paralysis dream. And I have to wonder if I might have caused that myself because I was picking up on weird vibes in the the Airbnb. It's an extremely old city. I'm not feeling 100% comfortable. Did that cause my experience? So when you have it in your head that there's going to be a ghost come out of there, and she does, it's clouded your experience because you're buying into it. And I think we do that today. You know, you went out on a ghost hunt. And did you have an experience or what? Did you kind of also set yourself up? Sometimes I think it's hard to tell.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think expectation does a lot to how we react to a creepy old building or spooky woods at night. You know, we sort of, our hackles get raised and blood pressure's rising and things like that. And I think we become more jumpy and more inclined to interpret things as paranormal. But yeah, I went on a ghost hunt, which was back at the place where I did the ghost hunter training. So I met some people who, interestingly, they didn't feel like they were being taught the right way to ghost hunt, as if, you know, there is a right way to do it. But they didn't feel like they really explored the building properly. So they asked me to come back with them a few months later. And they had a spirit box, which for any listeners that don't know what a spirit box is, it's a kind of modified radio that flits through radio stations very, very quickly and creates the most horrible static sound that's like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. It's horrible. It's just awful. I hate it. It seems to be particularly popular with sort of amateur British ghost hunters, that you have this spirit box and you put headphones on plugged into it and you wear a blindfold. So it's kind of sensory deprivation as you're listening to it. And so they said, oh, Alice, do you want to have a go? I was like, oh, yeah, great. Lovely. So I was sitting in this haunted prison. It was an old prison. I was sitting in this haunted prison and I was listening to this spirit box with headphones on and blindfold, and you can hear bits of radio stations, and allegedly you're supposed to be able to kind of hear ghosts speaking through you, but I'd never really understood it, and I thought, oh, it's just like bits of the radio. But anyway, I was listening to it and I could hear like bits of music or a bit of the weather, and I could hear this ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And then I think, and this is my rational explanation that I am clinging on to with my fingernails, because I don't know if I'm ready to actually consider the fact that it was a proper ghost. But the ch-ch-ch sound suddenly changed very vividly and very clearly into an angry man's voice going, no, 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 in my ears. And I had a full body visceral reaction. And I threw the headphones off, nearly threw this expensive spirit box across the room. It was horrible. I had this full body reaction to it, which I still think was my brain just being like, I don't like this static noise. I'm going to try and make sense of it. And it turned it into a man's voice. That's my rational explanation. But I don't know, maybe it was
a ghost. Know.
It was a bit freaky.
I'm going with paranormal.
Yeah.
Because you were in a haunted prison. You do bring up in one of the chapters, ghost laboratory. And so I do think that you can be influenced too by you're going into a haunted prison. Yeah. And I think they set up the experiment telling people there'd been a death there. So you get a different feeling. And so you go in there thinking there's been a death here. It's haunted. Mm. So I don't know. But in your case, you weren't really 100%. And you're like, okay, I'll try this, whatever. And then to have the experience is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was still fairly skeptical then, and I just kind of went with them because I wanted to see what a ghost hunt was like. And, you know, I thought it would be a kind of a fun thing to write about for the book. And I'd been listening to that spirit box for quite a while. You know, it wasn't like I just put it on and 10 seconds later I'd had this experience. I had been listening to it for quite a few minutes when it suddenly switched to a very angry and impolite man.
And that's who you would find in a prison as a ghost. I'm just telling you.
It was really scary. Even when I'm remembering it, it's still gives me the shivers, really.
I think I would have to do what you do, though. Well, but, you know, maybe this is what happened. I don't know. I found that interesting that you went to that length in researching the book, because you were skeptical and it's like, you know, I'll give this a try and see what it's all about. And I thought that was pretty cool that you did that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've found with some of my research that there does seem to be quite a lot of aggression between skeptics and believers. And I don't think it's as straightforward as that. I think you have to be a bit more sensitive and a bit more empathetic to both sides. But, you know,
there is a difference, though, between ghost hunting, paranormal investigations, and the spiritualist movement. There's definitely differences there. It's like, oh, and I can't remember, you kind of referred to the difference in the book at one point. I can't remember how you said that. But the spiritualist movement was more about an internal experience, more trying to get that connection with the loved one, whereas ghost hunting, you're out looking for a ghost, not necessarily the ghost of your son who you lost.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're kind of different there.
Yeah, spiritualism is more private, I think. And it's about more, yeah, more sort of small, intimate groups trying to process grief and bereavement. And there's more kind of a sense of intimacy with spiritualism, whereas ghost hunting, especially ghost hunting now, can just be a complete free-for-all, especially on YouTube and TikTok. It's not about grief and bereavement, really. It's just about kind of, you know, what weird things can I do to get the views.
And yeah, it's all about that and scares, and it's not about that connection with a loved one, which I think people still do that, searching out psychics and someone, you know, that's why they go see Teresa Caputo here in the U.S., the Long Island medium. And there's a lot of people who do that. And, you know, you go, and I went to see Teresa Caputo. I thought she was amazing. I'm like watching the people getting red next to me, and I'm like watching their faces. And I thought, they are really good actors if they are acting. I don't know how they set this up, but it was very interesting to me. So there's still that spiritualist movement alive today.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't realize. So where I come from in North Wales, my dad told me the other day that there's a spiritualist church not that far from kind of where I grew up, which I didn't realize at all. But it's interesting that you mentioned kind of like psychics and things, because at one point I was debating whether to go to a psychic and to try and, you know, get in touch with, so, you know, somebody that I've lost or something like that, but to do it from a skeptical point of view and maybe try and trick them a little bit. And I think actually the more I researched Ghosted, I think it made me more empathetic towards spiritualism. Mm-hmm. And I decided that actually it didn't feel right to do that. And I feel like I became just kind of a bit more respectful as a person in general, but, you know, of other people's beliefs, particularly to do with ghosts and spiritualism and spirits. So I'm quite glad now that I didn't do that, because I did plan to go and kind of make up a dead aunt in my head or something, and, you know, go and try and trick them into giving me information about somebody who doesn't exist or something like that. And I'm glad I didn't, actually, because I don't think it would have sat well with me afterwards, especially the way that Ghosted turned out, which is that it is quite a multifaceted sort of sensitive look, rather than just kind of saying, you know, I'm a skeptic and therefore I'm going to make fun of everything.
And you do not do that in the book at all.
No, not apart from when I buy a haunted doll from eBay, which is really funny.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Alice Vernon about her new book, Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking. You can find it wherever books are sold. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, then become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you very much for listening.